for another Star Trek podcast is over because we are just getting started with our post-show recap Star Trek coverage. And now, here are the two guys who are about to begin a Star Trek Discovery mission. I am Rob Cesternino, and I'm very excited to be bringing you some Star Trek podcasting here on Post Show Recaps for the very first time. This is going to be a series of podcasts where I am going to talk to a bunch of different people that I have met over the years who share a love for all things Star Trek, and I have invited a great guest here with me into the studio to talk about his favorite episode of Star Trek, which is The City on the Edge of Forever from Star Trek, the original series. Please welcome TV writer, survivor, all-around great guy, David Wright. David, how are you?
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me back. I'm so excited to talk all things Star Trek today.
Yes, I'm very excited that you were the first person that I thought of when I was going to begin this project of talking to people about Star Trek. I've known from even, the first time that we ever exchanged messages electronically that your avatar is you in the Star Trek uniform, a cartoon version of you in the Captain Kirk tunic.
That's right.
So I knew from then that we shared this mutual interest. And it's something that we have never really spoken about. In fact, I've almost never spoken about my passion for Star Trek that really was a major part of my life during my formative teenage years, and something that I haven't really thought a lot about since then, but I'm very excited to begin to discuss that, and I'm very excited to talk about it with you here today.
Yeah, me too. I hope this is a safe space.
Well, it is, because my wife is sleeping, and she has been... My wife is a staunch anti-Star Trek. I don't know what it necessarily is, and it really... around the time that I started dating my wife, she is a hater, and I don't know why. And again, she's one of these people that has sort of reinforced any sort of like negative stereotype associated with Star Trek, that it's nerdy, that it's uncool. And, you know, basically she is, you know, that thinking is old news.
I love that we had to wait for her to fall asleep before we could do this.
Yes. Well, she's very intimidating. So we are not even going to worry about what she has to say about any of this. And I'm very excited to talk with you. David, could you talk a little bit about how you came to become a fan of Star Trek?
Yeah. You know, this was back in the days before cable, when you had to, you know, find the signal with the rabbit ears. But my dad raised me on Star Trek. He was always a big fan. And I just fell immediately in love with it and these characters, the original series I'm talking about. So, you know, your Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Scotty. I've just never fallen out of love with it. I've seen every movie. And then TNG came around in the late 80s. I got into that. And then Deep Space Nine. And really enjoyed the original or the J.J. Abrams reboot from 2009, I think it was now.
Yeah, I personally, I didn't love that as much. I always loved the serialized TV version of Star Trek. And, you know, if you've listened to us, you know, me talk about this in the past, Next Generation was really my thing, where I really, you know, during the airing of that show and Deep Space Nine, that I was really way into that. Whereas myself, like, I watched the original series that I really got sort of exposed to. I had a cousin who was really, I really looked up to this cousin who was like a year older than me. And he got very into it, that he had like a Star Trek video game. And then I think it was like, I don't know if the episodes were on like Nick at Night or they were on some cable.
It was syndicated.
It was syndicated. And then also, then the episodes also started airing in, I grew up on Long Island, and WPIX Channel 11 in New York at one point started just airing the Star Trek episodes like every night at 7 or something like that. And I caught a lot of the original series probably when I was like 11 or 12 years old, around that time.
Nice. Yeah. No, I've been in it forever. I love it so much. I mean, I actually made a shot for shot recreation of the original titles in Maya, like a computer animated.
Wow.
Yeah, I spent an entire weekend doing it, and sadly, that was when I was in my 30s. So,
well, this is how big of a Star Trek fan that you are, because we're recording this on Friday the 8th, which turns out to be Star Trek Day. I had no idea when we originally booked this.
Yeah, the original series premiered 51 years ago today.
Yes, so that's very exciting. And you and I are friends on the Facebook, and you had posted something that you did on Facebook, which was really amazing. I watched the entire video, and I want you to set this up, and then I want to play a little segment of it.
Yeah, basically in 1992, I was a senior in high school, and there was this class trip in my choir to Disney's Magic Music Days, and we also stopped at Universal, and they had this Star Trek video thing there where you could, with a green screen, insert yourself into this footage that they shot specifically for this. So it was me and some of my choir friends, and I played the role of the captain.
Okay, so here is 1992 David Wright on the bridge of a green screen Enterprise.
That's right.
With some familiar voices that you may hear as well.
Let's test the ship's phasers.
Not now. That would be very dangerous.
I'm Captain Dave Wright. I'm pleased to serve you as your commander.
I'm Science Officer Adam Nevitt, reporting for duty.
That's what we need. Another Vulcan.
Bones really hated your friend.
He did. He did. I don't know what he had. Well, I guess he doesn't like Vulcans.
Doesn't
but,
like
you know.
Them. Yeah, so this was all in green screen, and you're in the movie uniform.
Yeah.
And there you are. And that's amazing. I mean, I was impressed with it for 1992.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, going back to like, you know, we're supposed to, as Star Trek fans, you're supposed to be like, hide it from the world. But after we shot that, some friends pressured me to show it on the bus in front of all the other choir students.
Why did you have to hide it from the world?
Because it wasn't safe. It wasn't safe to admit you're a Star Trek fan. It wasn't safe to be a geek.
I thought you meant like, hey, there'll be spoilers for people that come on the ride next time.
No,
you do an escape the room, and they're like, hey, don't take any pictures in here because you're going to ruin it for
right.
other people.
No, this was strictly about avoiding being beaten
up.
Yeah,
oh, yes, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
This is about the playgrounds.
No, and you and I were talking about this briefly, where I think that part of, you know, and I mentioned this about my wife, but, you know, when I was in high school, I was such a big Star Trek fan, and I didn't know anybody out there. The internet did not exist in the form that it does now, obviously. And I was just so afraid that, so, you know, people in my school were going to find out that I was like reading the like technical book of like the schematics of the Enterprise D, and could tell you about like all of these different like features and shuttle bays and stuff like that.
Yeah, in the 90s, if you love Star Trek, you had to walk around loving it in shame and in secret.
Right. You couldn't just be, you know, out as a Star Trek fan. It's very secretive. Of like, you couldn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
But that, and my wife is still in that world, David. So we don't have to tell her that. If she asks why you're here, we can just tell her that it was like something for Survivor.
Yeah, oh, please, yes, don't let it out.
Yeah,
but I don't know. I mean, it is. It's like kind of safe to be a geek these days.
Oh,
Comic-Con.
Yeah. No. Now I would have been like probably the homecoming king.
Oh,
of my
you would
high
have thrived.
Yes, born too late. So we're going to talk about the City on the Edge of Forever, and I just basically said to you, tell me your favorite episode, any of the Star Trek franchises, and we will just talk about it. And you went right to City on the Edge of Forever. Why this particular episode?
You know, I think it's one of those episodes of television, and it ends up on a lot of lists like this, where it's not just a great Star Trek episode. It's also like just a really great hour of television.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, they put it on their list of like top 100 episodes of television ever. And, you know, now we're in the golden age of television. So I think
peak
the list.
TV.
Yeah, we are. And so probably this is getting knocked down a few rungs, you know, with our Game of Thrones and everything. But I love the story. I love that basically Captain Kirk, who's like this womanizer, falls in love, and he has to decide whether or not he can. You know, this is the
spoiler
one,
alert.
Oh, is this? Oh,
no,
do we have to be careful?
No.
I hope
no,
not.
But I do feel like I think that people are going to listen to these podcasts. That I think you're going to have people that are sort of super hardcore fans that have seen the episodes many times. I think there are going to be people that like saw it a long time ago but don't really remember. And then there's also going to be people that never watched it but are just listening to the podcast. So yeah. I feel like that as much as we can sort of like be descriptive about what was happening, I think that that's going to be helpful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, basically, he falls in love for the very first time. That should not happen, Captain Kirk. He doesn't fall in love. He just, you know, he sleeps with women and then he moves on to the next planet. But yeah, he falls in love with Joan Collins. This is a well before her Dynasty days. And yeah, he has to decide whether or not, to save that love and have the, you know, the chance at true love or throw that away and basically save the universe.
Yes. And just to set that up, that there is a time travel component to this story where Kirk and Spock go back in time to the 1930 New York City. And there's a woman named Edith Keeler. She works in a homeless shelter. She ends up being a very important figure in human history because in the original first time through of human history that she ends up, I guess, getting hit by a car.
Yeah.
And so when Dr. McCoy, who ends up going mad due to an overdose of a medication, ends up going back and befriending her, he ends up stopping her from getting hit by said car. She goes on to become a major peace activist, prevents the United States from getting involved in World War II. Yeah. Germany develops the atomic bomb first and then takes over the world, and there ends up being no Federation of Planets, and Kirk and Spock are SOL in terms of the Enterprise being in orbit to get them off of this planet.
Exactly. Yeah, they're on this planet where they find the time portal, and they call up to the Enterprise and it's just not there anymore. And it's great too because Kirk says like that he and Spock are going to go into the portal to chase after McCoy, and then he walks up to Uhura and Scotty and then two other people. There are four people wearing red shirts, and he's like, you guys are going to have to try this one by one. But I mean, they're all wearing red. They're all going to die.
Yes. Yeah. So the episode eventually, you know, Kirk and Spock, I don't know this information yet, and Kirk has already fallen for this woman by the time he learns this, sort of like 2/3 of the way through. And then ultimately has to make the decision to let this woman that he's falling for die so that history can be rewritten. I mean, selfishly, he could have just stayed with Edith Keeler in 1930s and just but then again, eventually, you know, 15 years from now, he'll be living in a world that Germany has taken over and probably, you know, not so great for Kirk.
Not worth it. And it's funny, you know, the script was written by Harlan Ellison, who from the day that the episode premiered has just been a curmudgeon, because it was rewritten. The original ending was that Kirk did run out into the street to save her, and Spock, being the logical Vulcan, stopped him because, you know, he's maybe cold-hearted in that way. And so that's probably better storytelling, but I guess Gene Roddenberry felt that, like, well, how can we trust this captain going forward in the series if he made this really selfish decision? And so the ending became what the ending became.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do feel like that the original ending is probably truer to the characters.
I agree. Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's much better. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
so what we'll do is we'll talk through all of that and sort of like if you're okay with that, scene by scene, and just go through some of the what's great, what's ridiculously entertaining and silly through all of that. And what we're planning on doing here is that I'd like to do this like a bunch of times here in the month of September as we start to get ready for Star Trek Discovery to come to CBS All Access. And I think that I am very excited about a new TV version of Star Trek. Do you have high hopes for Discovery?
Huge hopes. You know, like months ago, there was a teaser that just showed special effects, and they looked terrible. They looked like something I could do, and that's not good. And then I saw the trailer about a month ago, a new trailer with the actors. And I'm like, wow, this is exciting. It seems like they've updated it. We've got a female captain. It's been a while since we've had that. And I think it's going to be great.
I say, who cares with the special effects? Because to me, I feel like that's not what it should be about. And that's been my frustration fascination with the Star Trek movies and why I like Star Trek as a TV show, because I feel like that Star Trek as a TV show really can get into a lot of issues. And I feel like that's what's interesting to me about Star Trek, that it's a story about like the good and the bad of humanity. And they can really explore that in a lot of different ways by holding up a lot of mirrors to ourselves via these different alien life forms that come into contact with the crew of the Enterprise and the various ships. Whereas the Star Trek movies, I feel like they tried very hard just to be like, hey, this is another version of Star Wars. This is our action franchise.
I mean, that's what happened. Star Wars came out in 77 while Paramount was working on reintroducing Star Trek to television audiences. Mm-hmm. And then they said, wait, forget that. This movie just made, you know, $200-300 million, whatever it was. And so, yeah, then they went forward and made this kind of special effects opus, which ended up just being a terrible movie.
Yeah, Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Exactly. Yeah, 1979. But then, of course, they made up for it with Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, which I love.
Yeah. So Star Trek Discovery is coming back. It's going to be airing on CBS All Access. That's sort of like the flagship show for CBS All Access that I know a lot of our listeners have subscriptions to that because of Big Brother, because that's how you are able to watch the live feeds on the Big Brother coverage that we do on Rob as a Podcast. If people are looking to get a subscription to CBS All Access, I believe it's $5.99 a month at this point, and we will have a link up at postshowrecaps.com. You could probably go to postshowrecaps.com/all access to go directly there and get that. But I'm really excited for there to be Star Trek back on, even though this is not television. That I'm excited for there to be a Star Trek series the first time since Enterprise went off the air. And I want to say that was 2005 or 2006,
yeah,
that Enterprise ended up. So it's been over a decade since we've had regular Star Trek on TV.
Yeah, and this looks, I think, drastically different. And I think that, I mean, it's hard to tell really from a trailer, but I'm just so excited about it. I don't even remember this alien character's name, but the one that can sense death coming, he seems like a cool guy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's important. You can also, you have that sense also.
Yes, well, I just think it's always coming every day. So yeah, I don't know if it's really a sense, but...
Yeah. In terms of the time period which it's set, I was a little disappointed to see that this was going to be another prequel to the original series. Were you okay with where? I think it's probably around 5 to 10 years before the events of Star Trek, the original series.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the weird thing of it all is, of course, like the technology is going to look more advanced than the series that allegedly takes place after it. But what can you do? Is 1960s TV. But yeah, no, I think I'm really excited to see what they do with it.
I was hoping that we would see a continuation of past the time frame of, you know, the Deep Space Nine Voyager era. I know Voyager ends up having a bit of a time jump at the end as well, but I would love to like revisit that time period.
Yeah, that would be cool. At the same time, you know, I noticed that they're reinventing the Klingons, which is with they look completely different now, and I don't know exactly what they're going for. Originally, they used to be basically based on the Russians, so I don't know who they're based on now, but they look cool.
Okay, so let's talk some City on the Edge of Forever. And the episode opens with a lot of turbulence going on that has to do with some sort of temporal disruption.
Yeah.
And the ship is shaking back and forth, ultimately causing Sulu's console to explode. There is going to be a lot of exploding console talk.
Yeah, look, it doesn't look safe, that those practical effects, by the way, to be sitting in front of them. And yeah, we get a close-up of Sulu, and you see he's wearing mascara. Which...
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. And again, I don't know if like I'm watching these things in better definition than I've ever watched them before, but it appears to be like, yeah, Sulu appears to be like heavily made up.
Yes, very much so, yeah.
I don't know what's going on there.
I don't know either, but I guess it was the trend or it's the fashion in the 23rd century.
I'm not sure. And so Sulu is injured. McCoy is called to the bridge and he has to help out Sulu, and he gives him a shot of a drug called Cortazine. I have this right?
That's right. Cortazine. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's tricky stuff.
It's tricky stuff. It's tricky stuff that everybody's like, hey, careful with that. That's a Cortazine. Like, look, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I know what I'm doing here. Ultimately though, because of some more turbulence, then McCoy ends up dosing himself with the hypo.
The full dose.
Cortazine overdose.
That's right.
Yes. And now he has become a madman.
He's deranged, and what's amazing is, yeah, he escapes the bridge after pushing some people very lightly out of the way. And amazing, too, the transporter chief, with, I think, one chop to the side, just renders him unconscious.
Yeah. Like, yeah. So McCoy, he ends up running into the turbo lift.
Yeah.
He escapes. He's like he's a madman. He's like ranting about assassination and
killers.
They're trying to kill me. And he ends up making like a beeline for the transporter room and does something that I've never really seen before. He sort of like does the version of like on your iPhone when you want to take a selfie in 10 seconds. Like he sort of like sets up the transporter console after he knocks out the transporter engineer with a lot of, I mean, that is a Star Trek staple that, I mean, Kirk has basically like the two-handed axe handle.
Highly effective.
Highly effective. I mean, Spock has the nerve pinch, but yeah, McCoy has like the judo chop where he could just like, I don't know if maybe he's like on an adrenaline rush, if he's like 10 times stronger than he normally
maybe
is.
Maybe that's what it is.
But I mean, this guy who just basically like a karate chop to the midsection, he was just knocked out cold.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I had that in my life growing up. It would have helped me so much with on the great or the playgrounds, rather.
You know, it's frustrating in this episode that nobody's. It's almost like that McCoy becomes invisible. I mean, that it seems like that none of the ship's sensors. I mean, if I lost my iPhone now, I could find it pretty quickly. They are unable to find McCoy in any way.
Yeah.
I mean, in Star Trek The Next Generation, they were able to like detect people if they had their communicator on.
Right.
But then there would be a lot of times somebody would just take their communicator off and like throw it in a drawer.
It didn't matter.
Would throw off the ship's sensors. Like, oh, Riker is in his bedroom. Like, or is he? But McCoy, I mean, even when they go down to the planet, McCoy is like just hiding behind a rock. Nobody is able to get a whiff of him.
Yeah, yeah, just a lot of paper mache rocks. He's able to just hide in the shadows.
He's like Arya Stark all of a sudden, that he's just like able to, he's becomes like this assassin where he's just like able to go around every corner and nobody can detect him.
Yeah, no, and he's a madman. He still thinks they're out to kill him.
Yeah, he's like a like ranting, drooling madman, yet he's like, you don't hear him like panting or anything like that. Nobody can track down.
No, really paranoid, yeah.
Where McCoy is. So they're combing the ship. They can't find him. Eventually, that guy that was so embarrassed that McCoy Chudo chopped him. He wakes up and says, oh, well, I think he beamed himself down. So
I would have said, I haven't seen him. I mean, why, you know, why set yourself up for a demotion?
Right. You feel like that they're going to really like bust that guy's chops for like the, like, hey, remember that time that McCoy, that wuss?
Yeah, yeah, and, that like, doctor.
Yeah. Judo chopped you and knocked you out and then beamed himself down. So we send an away team to go and look for McCoy on the planet, and it's a very old planet that they have a bunch of stuff there, and it's 10,000 centuries old. What's going on this planet?
Yeah, very old, very old. I can't even do the math of that. Yeah,
it's very old. And so we send Kirk, Spock, Uhura, Scotty, and two red shirts who actually survived the episode.
Shockingly, you're expecting them to die, but they live.
Yeah, the Enterprise had zero casualties in this episode.
Well, except the ones that were on the ship that didn't come down.
But then they came back. Edith Keeler, the only casualty.
Yeah.
And I guess she originally did die anyway. So
right, it's only fair. Edith Keeler must die, Rob.
Mm-hmm. And so we see this Guardian of Forever, this thing, this sort of, it's like a cross between like something that you might have at like a wedding reception and sort of like come out through, but it's also like a Stargate interdimensional time travel portal.
Yeah.
Were you impressed with the Guardian of Forever on the rewatch?
You know, no, especially because it also comes with a fog machine. So no, not so much, but and some weird like flashy, some of the light bulbs
up. Yeah,
yeah, it lights up, and some of them look like they're burnt out. It's like an old light bright or something.
And with all due respect, the Guardian of Forever is kind of a dick.
He is kind of a dick. Yeah, you ask him a very direct question, and he gives you a very confusing answer.
And Spock had no time for it. He's like, I don't see how riddles are helpful right now.
Yeah, Guardian of Forever. We're looking for our friend. Yeah.
And the whole time that Kirk and Spock are talking to this, you know, talking Stonehenge, then McCoy is just like hiding in the bushes.
Yes. Meanwhile, royalty-free film clips are playing on The Guardian.
Yes. So it is a gateway to your past. Now, why The Guardian of Forever is only showing highlights from Earth, and now I guess because Spock is half human, half Vulcan, I guess that they didn't bother with any highlights from Vulcan.
Yeah, you're right. It's a little Earth-centric. So Spock should be upset by that. It's entirely Earth.
Yeah. So it has a highlight film, and I guess if you jumped into The Guardian of Forever at the right moment, then you would be transported to that period in time.
And what if you're an alien beast that is much larger than the whole? Do you just not get to go?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, here's my question. Why is the footage that The Guardian of Forever showing in black and white?
Yeah, it's black and white. It's clearly shot on film. It's like, yeah.
Why was The Guardian of Forever only to... able to access newsreel footage of things from the past.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, he's saying that the centuries are passing so fast. It's like, no, we're watching like a scene from The Gladiator or something.
Yeah,
from,
nothing is passing fast. Like, you're watching like an army march in real time.
If anything, it's passing too slowly. We're gonna be here a while.
So eventually, security is able to round up McCoy, and they are able to hold him back. Spock comes in, gives him the nerve pinch, knocks him out. They think that he's sort of down for the count, but again, he's got that cortisone pumping through his veins.
And you should know, if you've got an entire dose of cortisone in your blood, you're not going to knock anybody out.
Right. It's like he's on like crystal meth right now.
Exactly.
He's just able to eventually bide his time. And, you know, Kirk, it's interesting that he's got kind of a crazy harebrained plan where McCoy, eventually, he's going to be fine. You know, they don't know a lot about cortisone, but it's going to, like, he's going to sleep it off eventually.
Well, I mean, the one guy that could tell them about is the guy that's drugged up, so they have to, wait for the doctor to heal.
Right, right. Basically, like, Edith Keeler gives him a cup of coffee in a day, and he's going to be fine.
It's a hangover at best.
Yeah. But Kirk says to Spock, like, oh, you know, Spock, could we time this right? Could we go through The Guardian of Forever and go back to yesterday and then warn ourselves not to let McCoy? I'm gonna have to say that's a bad plan, Captain. I don't think that's worth the risk.
Let's let him sleep it off. We'll go back to the ship. We'll give him, you know, give him some coffee. Just like, yeah. But unfortunately, McCoy is able to escape.
Yeah.
He wakes up.
Yes. As Kirk is sort of like pontificating, strangely compelling to look at. And then McCoy just like makes a beeline through The Guardian of Forever.
As you would if you were standing in front of one.
Yes. And so McCoy jumps through. Spock happened to be like holding up the tricorder up to The Guardian of Forever where he was recording the exact moment. You know, good luck that happened.
And I think Spock is just too hard on himself here too. He's like, I'm an idiot, Captain.
He's like, I could have been filming this the whole time. When would I have another opportunity to do this?
I mean, it'll loop back around again. Just hang out for a week or whatever.
Yeah, it's just basically like you're at like some terrible museum and there's like a 5-minute loop of like the history of the Earth that plays over and over again.
They didn't pay to get in. It was free admission. Yeah. There's some stale donuts or something.
So they are sort of at a loss. Okay, what do we do? McCoy just went through the time portal, and now the communicators aren't working because the ship isn't there. Now, David, we're going to talk a lot about paradoxes here in this episode. Are you buying, like, what's going on here? Is there, like, are the people that are within the vicinity of the Guardian of Forever, they're just sort of immune from what's going on?
It's kind of the buy you have to make. Yeah, there's sort of like this bubble, this temporal bubble that no matter what happens in history or what has changed, if you're inside this bubble, it doesn't matter.
Okay, so they're trying to figure out exactly where he went through, because if Kirk and Spock can time the jump, that they can get within like a month of where McCoy landed. And Kirk, yeah, he does tell those guys, like, hey, just so you know, if this doesn't work, then you're all going to have to try to do this. Now, when they come back at the end of the episode, you were gone for a second. So I don't know, at what point would it be safe for them to give it a shot?
Yeah, and you know, that's a good question. And they also don't even really show, like, how they know where in this town in New York to jump through. I mean, I don't know. There's no portal in New York.
Yeah, they just sort of appear on the other side. You know, Spock sort of like elegantly explains it as well as you can, that he says that like time is like a river and everything ends up going into one stream. So they all come out at the same like tributary.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just sci-fi BS, basically.
Yeah,
it
all goes downstream. So Kirk and Spock make the jump, and they land in the 1930s Depression-era New York.
Which looks suspiciously like the Paramount lot of the 60s.
Yes.
Or wherever it was shot.
We hear about the economic upheaval of the time.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's Depression-era New York, and of course, Spock's a Vulcan. He's got his pointy ears. They're going to need to explain him. And they're dressed, as they point out, not for the time. So they need some clothes.
Yeah. Legitimately, how many times do Kirk and Spock visit 20th century United States?
Way too many. And in fact, they should know more about it with as many times as they've been
there.
I mean,
there's sometimes they visit a planet that has adopted, like, we have recreated 20th century United States.
Yeah, yeah.
But they certainly here, certainly in Star Trek IV, Voyage Home. I know they go to like 1960s at one point.
Not in that movie, but
not in that movie.
In
another episode.
Yeah, another episode they go 1960s. I remember it's like it's Apollo or before the Apollo program, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And they get spotted as a UFO.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. So at least three times and maybe more. And so here they are back, and you know they're on the street in their Star Trek uniform, which is very humorous. Like, I really did enjoy watching Kirk and Spock have to deal with this.
Yeah, yeah, they got to steal some clothes, and
Well, I want to talk about that. So,
oh yeah,
so Kirk and Spock, they realize, okay, well, you know, we are. You know, look too out of the ordinary here. We need to do something about these clothes. We need to do something about Spock's ears. And they end up being stopped by a police officer. And, you know, Kirk is basically saying right before that, you know, we've got this on lockdown. This is going to be fine. And they're going to steal some clothes. But then they get stopped by a police officer on the street who had this to say to Kirk.
Well, you're a police officer. I recognize the traditional accoutrements.
He was saying you'll have no trouble explaining it.
My friend is obviously Chinese.
Kirk, stop.
That's a fail.
Kirk.
Yeah, total fail.
Nope.
It was the 60s.
Captain.
Yeah.
Captain.
Not a bright
belay
moment.
That order, sir.
Exactly.
Nope.
What they should do is jump into the Guardian to before Kirk said that so they can prevent a very uncomfortable moment in television history.
We need to go back. He's not Chinese.
That's not right. Yeah, and then apparently all women are just wives of men in the 60s, according to when they talk to the police officer.
Yeah, because that's how they get out of that jam.
Yeah.
That the police officer is like, all right, stick him up. And then Kirk says to the police officer, oh, wait, hold on. I noticed something. How careless of your wife to let you leave the house like that. And the guy's like, what? What happened?
Because his wife doesn't have a job, clearly, right? Because she's a woman. Which is very strange because this episode... At the center of it has this really powerful, strong woman. Yet, but hang on, everybody else, you know.
Poor choice of words.
Yes.
My friend is obviously Chinese. I see you've noticed the ears. They're actually easy to explain.
Like, I feel like he should have just said he's an elf. That would have been, you know, a better lie.
They didn't really think this through. Again, you know, they were in a very unique situation.
Yeah, caught off guard.
They'll get Spock a ski cap that he'll wear
exactly.
Most of the rest of the episode.
Although that still doesn't explain his mascara and his weird eyebrows, but whatever.
So they end up like running into this basement, which happens to be the basement of this homeless shelter, the 21st Street Mission. And we see them first. They're talking about what could they do. That Spock recorded the stuff with the tricorder. He could build some sort of rudimentary computer, they think, eventually to be able to access this information. I didn't really understand why Spock needed to build a computer to access what was on the tricorder.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, until you said it in this moment, I never really considered that.
It's almost like I have an iPhone, but I need to sync it to the computer. So yeah. I can't download this just on the app.
Yeah.
I need to connect the phone to a computer so then I can access what's on the phone from iTunes.
Seems like a poor design of 23rd century Steve Jobs. Yeah, I don't know why it's necessary. But yeah, you should just be able to play it on the tricorder. But no, you called it a zinc-plated vacuum tube culture, right?
Because they still are looking at the screen of the tricorder.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the peripheral is building.
Is it possible it wasn't necessary and Spock didn't know that?
I don't know. I mean, that doesn't make any sense if that's the case. But I don't understand why.
Yeah.
Like, I get it that they couldn't have just accessed all that information early in the episode. I understand plot-wise, but I don't understand just from a technical side.
It's ironically illogical.
So they end up encountering Joan Collins here in this episode. Now, I don't know a lot about Joan Collins besides what we were saying earlier about her being on Dynasty, but was she famous at the point that she was in this episode?
I don't believe so. You know, I'm not really sure what the beginnings of her career were, but she looks beautiful. They give her the Sybil Shepherd gauze in the
80s. It's like distracting whenever they do the close-up of her. I'm like, is there something wrong with my TV? Why is she so out of focus?
Yeah, I guess we're just supposed to kind of see her through Kirk's eyes. And she's just like incredibly, I don't know.
Yes, Kirk's love goggles Joan Collins. And so, yeah, she's all blurry, but she ends up giving Kirk and Spock a job working at the mission for 15 cents an hour.
Yes, really easy to get a job in 1930s Depression era New York, apparently.
Yeah, and they're just going to like sweep up and do stuff around there. The mission is kind of a weird place, right?
It is. It is a weird place. And, you know, she seems to be the only one working there.
Again, I don't know a lot about the Depression era New York.
Nor do I.
I guess nobody was working, but you needed a place for all the people that would have been working to go sit around and drink coffee.
You do, I suppose, yeah. But also kind of weird that why did they cast Joan Collins? She's a British woman. Like, it just seems like you should, or like we should just put it in London then or something.
I don't know. I don't know exactly why. I guess that she needed to be an American to be able to ultimately get the ear of FDR.
Yeah. Very strange. I don't know.
So we see Kirk and Spock go to work at the soup kitchen, and obviously they get to eat there. We don't know a lot about Edith Keeler's platform yet at this point, but Kirk has a illuminating conversation with one of the pervier bums that happens to frequent the 21st Street mission. He gives Kirk a warning, and Kirk is really not having it with this guy.
You'll be sorry.
Why?
You expect to eat for free or something? You gotta listen to Goody Two-Shoes.
And now, as I'm sure that somebody out there has said, it's time to pay for the soup.
Did anybody ever say that it's time to pay for the soup?
Yeah,
you have to listen to a speech.
I think she's like inventing or coining, or rather quoting a phrase that doesn't actually exist. Yeah,
yeah,
coining it.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe that Edith Keeler was gonna get big and then she died.
Yeah, you're right. That's what would happen.
It never happened. But besides, okay, so it's time to pay for the soup. This guy really does not want to hear it.
Not that she's a bad looking broad, but she really wanted to help out a fella in need.
Shut up.
Shut up.
Shut up. Shut up.
Yeah.
Where was that with the cop, Kirk?
Yeah, yeah.
Boy, if she really wanted to, she's not a bad looking broad, but if she really wanted to help a guy out.
I mean, I think the deal is if Kirk's in love, just stay out of his way, all right? Just don't hurt his love interest. Don't offend her in any way.
Edith Keeler really wanted to help the homeless in the Depression era.
Yeah.
Shut up. So she ends up giving a really touching speech, Edith Keeler.
Yeah, it's basically Gene Roddenberry's philosophy of the future in a nutshell, which is this optimistic view.
Again, I think probably the 21st Street mission, the homeless shelter, probably that's not the right place for this speech. It's like a great speech,
yeah,
but know your audience.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
I don't know if necessarily out of work, depression era guy that is, you know, eating gruel wants to hear about, hey, you know, we're only a few years away from splitting the atom. And then after that, we're going to the moon.
Yeah. Do they really care? Probably not.
Like, I think she really needs to work on the stump speech here for the homeless.
Although what she doesn't realize is the most important audience is Kirk. This man may save her life because of this speech.
Yes. Yes. But to me, and as you mentioned, the Gene Roddenberry vision, I think that this is the thing that is so exciting about Star Trek for me. And one of the reasons why I'm so excited for a Star Trek series to return, the original Star Trek series airs in the 60s, a very tumultuous time. And I don't think I'm saying anything controversial by saying that we now currently are in another very tumultuous time. And I think that for me, the message of Star Trek has always been a hope in humanity, where that Star Trek is not about, you know, any particular ideology, but just to say that, you know, the best days for human beings are still to come, that in the Star Trek mythology, humanity has, you know, even a third world war to come in the Star Trek mythology. But out of that, that we end up encountering the Vulcans and another life form.
Yeah.
And humanity is able to look at each other and say, we have much more the same than we have different. And we're able to pool our resources together. And then there is no hunger. There is no suffering among people, for the most part, coming out of a period of great conflict.
Yeah. Although at the end of the day, they still solve a lot of their problems with phasers and photons.
Sure. Sure. But there's very little of, like, I don't like this person because they're from this other part of Earth.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, actually, not to talk shop too much, but Gene Roddenberry, when he made TNG, when he brought it back, his mandate was that none of the cast members, the ensemble, could have conflicts with each other, which made it really hard for the writers to come up with stories because everybody was is the get-along gang.
Yes. And, you know, that's almost like a different point of, like, that certainly people in an office work setting will have conflict with one another, but they won't have, you know, a hatred for one another in terms of, you know, differences between them.
Gender and race and all that. Yeah, those things are in the past in the Star Trek universe.
And yeah, and so the idea of, like, all of these different, you know, ultimately human beings, and then bringing in other races of different planets, and then trying to get, you know, in this United Federation of planets. Like, there is a lot of things that you can be inspired about from this mythology.
Oh, yeah. I would love to live in the Star Trek universe. You know, I just bought an Alexa, and I feel like I am. I love her so much.
Yeah. Why? What do you say to the Alexa?
Oh, I say, well, actually, if you say Alexa, Tea Earl Grey hot, she'll say that the replicators are offline. But yeah, it's, I have her play music. I have her give me recipes. I have her tell me what time it is.
My big problem is, so I have the Siri on my phone. I have an Alexa, and I have the Google.
What do you call Google? Is that just Google?
I don't want to say, because sometimes people listen to these podcasts and then it sets off their things.
Okay.
And it might have just even happened by you saying Alexa. But the problem is, it's like I'm dating three women. It's like I have this relationship. Like, sometimes I hold up my phone. It's like, hey, Google. Siri.
My writing partner says I'm too stern with mine. So.
Yeah. No, it's a very complicated relationship. So Edith Keeler has gotten a room for Kirk. She says that she has a vacant room for $2 a night. I mean, I think this could have been misconstrued by Kirk. I'm glad that he was, you know, classy about everything.
Yeah, it's not implied that Spock's going to be in this room. It sounds like just Kirk. He's got, you want to spend the night in my flop, you know?
Yeah. Now, a vacant room for $2 a night, if Kirk and Spock work for 15 cents an hour, is this a good deal?
Oh, God. I'm going to say it's not a good deal. No.
I mean, Kirk and Spock work 10 hours a day at 15 cents an hour. They each have $1.50 at the end of the day. The room to stay in is $2. Kirk's got to go to the 1930s Radio Shack and buy all these computer parts for Spock. Spock is going to ask for a brick of platinum later on in the episode.
Plus, fresh produce. That's not cheap.
Yeah. I don't know.
We find out that Spock is a vegetarian. I did not know that until this episode.
So, in the next scene, they come home and Spock has gotten a lot of work done on the computer. We don't know how much of a time jump there's been since we first got this room set up. Kirk has a bag full of groceries, including the TV staple, a loaf of French bread. He also has like a log of bologna. I don't know how he's going to slice that.
Yeah, which is what he plans on eating. But you're right. Where did all this money come from? They don't have it. He clearly stole that.
I think Kirk and Spock have stolen a lot of money.
A lot. Which Edith seems almost, it's like a power play on her part. She's trying to keep them
I think they're sort of like, well, the end justifies the means. You know, we're trying to save humanity here.
Yeah, fair enough.
But does baloney exist in the 23rd century? Kirk and Spock seem to both know what baloney is. Kirk has gone out and bought a large tube of baloney.
Yeah, processed meats existing in the 23rd century. I'm not okay with that.
Well, now, is it sort of like processed meats? Is it along the lines of like a synthahol type thing where it is the feel and the taste of bologna, but it's, you know, not actually any sort of processed meat?
Yeah, well, that's definitely one thing Star Trek got wrong. There will absolutely be alcohol in the 23rd century.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the synthahol never made sense to me where it's like, oh, it looks and smells and tastes like the real alcohol, but you don't get drunk. Like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to drink a glass of whiskey for the taste of it.
Yeah, Starfleet Academy freshman year must be just awful.
I don't really understand what's going on there. You understand why the Romulan ale ends up being so popular, but they've got this computer.
Sorry, not to interrupt, but an illegal Romulan ale is illegal. So is there prohibition in the 23rd century then? Is that what we're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
They brought it back.
Yeah.
Well, I think the idea is that there's not prohibition. People just don't want to get drunk.
Right. Okay. Yeah. We've evolved.
Because I guess that I don't know where Gene Roddenberry came down on this, but I think it seems like, well, people are probably drinking because of like for whatever reason, and whatever reason that you might have to drink and consume alcohol does not exist anymore.
It's all book clubs in the future. Just people discussing books.
Yeah. Playing books, playing musical instruments. Yeah. Like these are the ways people will pass the time. So we see, Spock is really becoming a bit of a negative Nancy about the whole situation. He describes the tools that he has to work on these computers like, Captain, it's like I'm working with stone knives and bearskin to build this computer for you.
Yeah, and I feel bad for him because I feel like on the Enterprise, there's probably a couple buddies we don't know that Spock had that he could vent to about what it was like on the bridge. But here he is alone in this flop. He's not, he's not respected. And he's doing all the work. Meanwhile, his captain's falling in love and dating.
Yes, he's like going out like, I guess I'll just be here building the computer all week.
Yeah.
I'll need some more light bulbs for this computer.
Yeah, meanwhile, Kirk is going to go to a movie and make out with Joan Collins.
So back at the mission, they are cleaning up as they do, and there happens to be one of these depression guys who is fixing a cuckoo clock with a bunch of tools.
Yeah, my issue with this scene too is that so Spock has clearly been there sweeping a while, and then clearly this clock is these parts have been out here for hours, and he just now notices.
Oh, interesting. Like, I could use those cuckoo clock repair parts on my
look up
computer. And so, ultimately, Kirk and Spock will steal those tools, which I think speaks to the fact that Kirk and Spock are basically like the wet bandits of the 1930s New York.
I mean, I just don't think there was enough negotiation when they were offered the salary they were offered.
Well, I guess they figured like, hey, well, fine, 15 cents an hour just to work here. I'll get to talk to Edith Keeler. And then at nighttime, we'll be out prowling and stealing stuff left and right.
Yeah, and maybe Edith will pay a couple times when we go out.
Sure, sure. And then we'll have Edith Keeler to look at, and then also we can go ahead, because they don't know that she's like the hub of everything that they're there to stop.
No, no. Although they will soon.
They will soon. But Edith Keeler finds out about they stole the tools. I'm not. How does she know that?
You know, she was able to tell that the lock was picked somehow, but I don't know how.
I think it was probably like, hey, you know those two shady guys who hang around here who are real weirdos?
Yeah.
Like, maybe it might have been them.
That guy that always wears the hat indoors?
That we've never seen before? Exactly. And everybody else looks like they're really a dirty homeless person.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
There's these other two guys. maybe it was them.
And by the way, why did they never ever have to give back the clothes that they stole? Edith didn't care about that. But these
well, I don't think she knew they stole clothes.
Okay,
I think they just showed up wearing those clothes.
Yeah.
They were already in the basement at that time.
Okay, good. All right.
Yeah. My big question is at the end of the episode, when they go back through the Guardian of Forever, they're back to their Federation uniforms. Did they change before that? Like, were they like ready to beam home? Because they're wearing the 1930s clothes
yeah.
when Edith Keeler dies. They have the moment where it's like Bones is like, do you know what you just did? And Spock is like, he knows. And then... You know, then they, it's, and it's not like they quantum leap out of there
no.
right after that happens. I don't know. Did they have like an hour or so to like see if like, maybe Edith Keeler was still like, she could have lived. Like she was like in critical condition.
Yeah.
And they're like, I guess we better change because.
And when it probably happened in the flop, and then it's like, did Kirk and Spock change in front of each other, or did they like, hey, okay, you have the room for like a minute?
I guess they probably had a bathroom. I didn't see a toilet
okay.
in there.
Yeah,
it wasn't
fair.
Like, yeah.
That's probably what it was.
I don't know what the indoor plumbing situation was at a flop
yeah.
in 1930.
But I love even when Kirk is super depressed, he tucks the shirt in, he's going to look just right, pressed, everything.
So, Edith Keeler, she's not happy that the guys stole stuff, she ends up like getting walked home by Kirk.
That's right, yeah, yeah, and I believe she says, "Let me help." And mm-hmm. he says that, you know...
yeah, what is this about? What is going on here?
Yeah, yeah. He starts referencing this author that hasn't been born yet on a faraway, distant planet.
Yes. So, yeah.
And she doesn't think this is weird.
Yes. Yes. She says the phrase, "Let me help." And he's like, well, you don't know this yet, but that's actually going to be a very popular expression in about 100 years.
Yeah.
That there's going to be somebody that you don't know on another planet that, right? Is like, what? What is Kirk talking about?
Yeah. And isn't the right response from Edith Keeler now, okay, you know, we don't really require your services anymore.
It's like, oh, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
You're a crazy person.
Exactly.
You're on drugs.
Yeah.
And this is over, and you're fired.
Yeah, it's like, it's why you don't meet people on Bumble. Yeah.
Because, again, Kirk doesn't know yet at this point, like, well, Edith Keeler's going to die anyway, so I could just sort of, like, offload anything I need to with her and tell her, you know, by the way, you are right about the space travel thing. That is correct, but you have to die now, so
yeah.
Take that to your grave.
Well, it's great. Like, he met her, like, 45 minutes ago, and he's already sounding like a crazy person, so kudos to her for not running in the other direction.
Yeah. And she also ends up like asking a lot of questions like, so why does Spock call you captain? Were you in a war together? And he's like, well, we served together.
Yeah. He's willing to say this crazy thing about the author on a planet
mm-hmm.
100 years from now, but he's not willing to say, oh, and by the way, I work on a starship. I mean, you've come this far. Just, you know, tell her everything.
Yeah. So Spock is able to hook up the tricorder and he sees that a social worker is killed. He's able to sort of access the... newsreel of or newspaper microfiche of that Edith Keeler died in some sort of an accident.
Yes, yes. But he's not sure if that is what did happen or what happens as a result of McCoy.
Yes. And so he ends up when Kirk comes home telling him about this. And he says, you may find this distressing. And so we end up finding out then the alternate history is that Edith Keeler goes on to meet with FDR and they confer for some time. And in 6 years, we'll see this end up taking place. And then she ends up being the person that prevents the U.S. from getting involved in stopping the Nazis in World War II. How does Edith Keeler rise to such prominence?
That's a really great question. They don't really explain that too well, do they? How did she get this access to FDR? I guess she just made a really great impression with this mission or something.
I guess she just is taking this speech on the road.
Yeah.
She gets out of the homeless missions and she goes to all these other places. And then, it's interesting. Like, I had read on Wikipedia that Joan Collins described Edith Keeler in later interviews as a Nazi sympathizer.
What?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yes.
What a dark, like, point of view.
Well, I mean, you could certainly have that interpretation of that maybe she wanted to prevent the U.S. from intervening with the Nazis because she was like, okay, well, you know, that they have some ideas.
Oh my God! Well, this is a hot take. This is the first I've heard of this.
I'm telling you what I've read on the Wikipedia for The City on the Edge of Forever. Okay. Joan Collins said that Edith Keeler was a Nazi sympathizer.
Oh my God! Well, Edith Keeler must die then. Okay, that's fine.
Now, maybe Joan Collins was sort of like being overprotective of her, that's why, you know, that character had to die because
I see.
That's why.
God. You know, yeah, I guess if it makes you okay
with
it.
She was kind of okay with the Nazis because she wanted to stop. She says she thought that we shouldn't have intervened in World War II.
But that kind of sabotages Kirk's character because he fell in love with a Nazi sympathizer.
But he didn't know.
That's true. Okay, fair
enough. Well, what does Kirk know about Nazis? And,
yeah.
You know, he just like sees a beautiful woman. She's talking mumbo jumbo about like one day people are going to go to space. Like, oh, space.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. So he's excited about that. I mean, Kirk falls in love every episode. You can't blame him. He's probably, you know, been in love with worse people.
But this is a hardcore crush. Hardcore.
Yes. Well, I've heard it said that Edith Keeler was Kirk's true love. That okay. he never loved anyone else the way that he loved Edith Keeler.
What about Carol Marcus?
Yeah, I feel like that was sort of a strained.
I think so. I think they had too much to drink.
She got pregnant.
Yeah.
And was like,
and he's like, well, I've got this duty. And, you know, whatever. But... Yeah, she said, you begged me to stay away, or I did what you told me to do. I stayed away. Like, come on.
Yeah, that was an excuse. Edith Keeler, she ends up becoming like a big deal. She has a meeting with FDR. She prevents the U.S. from getting involved in World War II, and then the Nazis end up developing the atomic bomb. And this is, that's how Man in the High Castle, I think, got started.
I know nothing about Man in the High Castle. I
watched the whole first season.
Okay.
It was right after my younger son was born. Like, it just like up all night. And I watched the whole thing like in a weekend. And then a year later, the second season came on. And it's like, I don't remember who anything is. I don't want to catch up.
And this,
I just never watched the second season.
This was if Germany won World War II?
Yes.
Basically? Okay,
yes,
gotcha.
That's basically,
yeah.
It takes place actually, I think, in like the 60s.
Okay.
In the sort of version where the Nazis control half of the United States.
Gosh.
And then the Japanese powers control the other half of the United States, like divided by like the Grand Canyon.
Okay, geez.
It's a fine show. It was so complicated, and that's the problem with, like, you binge watch these shows in a weekend, and then you have to, then a year later, who can remember what happened?
Well, and it starts to feel like homework.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, so forget about that.
Yeah.
If Edith Keeler could have prevented that, then they should have let her live.
They absolutely should have let her live.
If that was her speech of, you know, that I don't think that, I think that shows should be once a week in the future, people will be able to just watch the show at their leisure.
It should not be serialized.
They shouldn't have to spend your entire weekend catching up with the show and then you forget it. And then a year later, you don't know who any of the characters are.
But still 15 cents an hour.
And then the guy's like, well, if this broad really wanted to help out.
Well, that guy gets his comeuppance, you know.
Yes. Why? What happens to that guy?
He's the guy who ends up finding McCoy's phaser.
Put two and two together.
Yeah. And then he just melts.
Good. So,
yeah.
Good. That guy always starts, shut up.
I'll bet Kirk would feel really bad if he knew that the guy he told to shut up
That guy deserved it. That guy had a comment. All right. So finally... we end up seeing McCoy jump into the 1930, and he's like still like ranting, murderers, assassins, what is this? What's going on?
Yeah. Still drunk. Still drunk. Because only a second has passed from when he jumped through on the planet.
Yeah. And we see some more of Kirk now back out with Edith Keeler. And now this is the first time that he's interacting with her, knowing that, okay, this is what probably has to happen. But he says, well, we don't have to do anything until McCoy shows up.
Right.
I mean, you know, we could have like a year with her where I could just like sort of have this relationship and then kill her later.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it kind of reminds me of like when you're dating a girl and all your friends know she's wrong for you and they're trying to give you hints.
But they're not around.
Yeah. Well, Spock's trying. He's trying his best.
It's like, oh, well, I'm going to go off to college at the end of the summer. So this is fine. This is fine. And so she's talking about how man is going to the moon. She makes a good point. She, like, basically, this is a little bit more of her speech. She says, like, well, what if we took all the money that we spend on war and death and spend it on life? And Kirk's like, yes, that's right.
Yeah. Great idea.
We will do that.
Just not now.
Yeah. And that's really the lesson of the episode that Spock, I think, is going to say later, that she was right. She had the right message, but it was too early.
Yeah, it's a fundamental rule of Survivor. Timing is everything, right?
Timing is everything.
Yeah.
Like, we should be, you know, in complete harmony with the rest of the world, just not yet. That's sort of the message of this episode.
Yes, that's exactly
it. Because not everybody is on the same page. So if we all end up saying, like, oh, let's all have harmony right now, well, there might be bad guys that say, okay, good, now's the time to strike.
That's exactly it.
That's why we need, when the aliens eventually come, that's what will ultimately unite humanity.
First contact.
First contact,
yeah.
Right. And thank goodness that in the first contact, the Vulcan, I mean, that was really the best case scenario. The Vulcans showed up and they were friendly and they had like a lot of good tips for us. You know, there's also the Independence Day scenario where the aliens show up. But if we can somehow get through the bad guy aliens, then I think everybody will really be on the same page.
What do you think is more likely?
I think probably the second scenario is more likely. I mean, that would be really exciting if we just sort of had like benevolent aliens that showed up and said, hey, look, we know you guys are going through a lot. We're here to help. And here's a bunch of I said people wouldn't trust them. Some people would trust them. I think we'd be just as divided. We need bad aliens to come. That their intentions will be clear. We'll all get on the same page. And then, you know, sort of like be like brothers and sisters in arms.
Yeah, that's right. It will unite us. You're right.
And then if we can get through that, then we'll all be on the same page. The problem is that, well, how do we get through it?
You know, they just picked up a really weird radio signal in space.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Not aliens, though. Not aliens.
But what was it?
They don't know what it is, but it's not aliens.
The Guardian of Forever?
Maybe. Maybe that's what it is.
He could be out there. So McCoy ends up dropping his phaser on the ground, and then that's where the homeless guy ends up blasting himself.
Yeah, and I feel like the homeless guy is only in a position to find that because he kind of felt unwanted by Kirk in the mission.
Shut up. Shut up.
And he's like, well, I'm not wanted here. I'm going to go for a walk.
Yeah. Yeah. Kirk and Spock, they bullied him into going and picking up a phaser. He didn't know what it was.
It seemed pretty painless, at least.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, they really, that nobody puts a phaser on stun in this episode where they're trying to like get McCoy to like on the planet, at least. They sort of like leave it to security guards to sort of wrestle with him and Spock to come in and do the nerve pinch.
Yeah. Yeah. Really poor planning on their part.
I mean, I feel like that if I was, you know, a Starfleet security officer, I'd just have that thing set to stun. I'd come in, stun everybody, and then just figure it all out later.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, for sure.
You know, it stings to get stunned.
Does
like,
it?
Is there some neurological lasting impact, perhaps?
I think we're going to find that there is.
It's like a CTE type thing.
Yeah, probably.
But I think one stun, I think you're fine. And I feel like that they could fix it if there's some sort of like synapse that ends up getting like shorted out. I think that they could fix that. But just a stun first. And ask questions later.
I mean, you know, it's better than him jumping through the portal and changing all of time, right? All of history.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been an easier solution, an easier fix than what Kirk was proposing. So McCoy is like ranting and talking about like, where are the doctors? They cut and sew people. Like, he's really just talking gibberish and not even anything like it made more sense when he was talking about assassins. Now he's like ranting about doctors.
Yeah, not a great last 20 seconds.
Like, well, you
seconds.
Are a doctor.
Yeah, not a great last 20 seconds of this guy's life.
Mm-hmm. So Kirk ends up coming back, and he knows what he has to do at this point. You know, he sort of like comes to terms with it. We talked about Sulu and his makeup also in this episode. The McCoy broken out in hives is not great.
Not great. No, it's like really poor man's Walking Dead or something.
I don't know what is going on. It's like they just like took like a paintbrush and just like jabbed him with it in the face.
Yeah, and I want to say that they're not even consistent. I feel like they hop around his face from cut to cut, but something to look for in another viewing.
McCoy has also found the homeless shelter. Edith Keeler has like a giant kettle of coffee and she's pouring, and then McCoy ends up just like coming into this, just like, oh, is that coffee you're making?
Yeah. And by the way, I think he cut in line. Pretty much everyone in the 23rd century has no manners,
right? Also, nobody really seems to shame McCoy about his Star Trek uniform. That everybody, like Kirk and Spock, just like from the second they arrived, everybody's like, what is wrong with you? But I guess McCoy, I guess he looks like a crazy person.
Yeah, I guess Hives is a get out of jail free card in terms of wardrobe.
And so Edith Keeler says, oh, look at you. You look terrible.
Yeah.
She's like, let me put you on a cot. How come Kirk and Spock had to pay $2 a night for a flop? McCoy gets a free cot.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah. He doesn't even have to work there.
That's unfair.
And so Kirk and Spock, they're sort of like this is when they sort of like go through everything with, you know, all of the details about what ultimately happened. And so this is Kirk trying to find out from Spock, what day did she die?
Yeah. Yeah, which they should be able to find. They're able to find a newspaper article, you think?
You would think so.
Yeah, yeah.
He tells Spock, he comes out and confesses, Spock, I believe I'm in love with Edith Keeler.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, not good. Not good. No. The 23rd century womanizer has now fallen in love for the first time. And because of that, we're all going to have to suffer.
Thank God Spock was there with Kirk and Kirk wasn't with me, because I feel like I would have not have taken that news as well as Spock took it.
Yeah. No, you're right. Wait, what?
Yeah. What do you mean that you're in love with her?
We came here on a mission.
Yeah, this was the one reason we came here was to fix this. You've known her for a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we'll go back to the 23rd century. You can hang out on Rigel. You meet a lot of women there.
Yeah, well, you'll have a new girlfriend next week.
Yeah, oh yeah, and she'll be wearing less.
Yeah, she'll be green.
Yeah.
And stop it.
Stop it. You'll be back to a 23rd century salary.
Like, this is classic Kirk. This is so you.
Yeah, it makes it all about
every
him.
Time. he was, Spock was just, a little bit of just like a captain.
I also love it too, because this is another example of William Shatner. He would manipulate the directors in the original series, and he would have it like, how about I have my back to the guy I'm talking to and the camera's just looking at my face? And so he does that. It basically, Spock is talking to Kirk's back.
The Wikipedia did say also that there was an issue that Spock originally had more lines than Kirk in this episode.
Oh, poor Spock with his celery and his transistors.
So McCoy wakes up. What is McCoy talking about as he starts to come to?
He comes back to health and he's like, he thinks that he's imagining all of this, but I've decided that you're real.
Yes. Yeah. He's like trying to say, is this either a fever dream or this is a side effect, or I can't figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, either way, this is, I don't know. This is not real.
But it seems like McCoy is already starting to fall in love with her, too.
Oh, yeah. He's sort of, but he's in the friend zone.
Yeah, so, right, exactly.
McCoy has been friend zone immediately.
He has no idea. Yeah. He's just a puppy at this point.
Okay. There's this really interesting scene where, finally Kirk ends up saying that he is going to go through with this. All right. He understands Edith Keeler has to die, but that he is on, like, he meets her like at the bottom of a stairwell, and that they're both on the stairs, and she ends up tripping.
Yeah.
And she's going to fall down the stairs, and Kirk catches her.
That's right.
Kirk prevents her. Spock is furious.
Yeah, he's like, that could have been it. Like, she might have died right there, and then we mission accomplished.
Like, she really could have let her all fade down the terrace. And like, wouldn't have been the worst thing in the world, Kirk, if you would have just let her fall down the stairs.
So cold-hearted. God.
I mean, at this point, why don't they just murder her?
Right? I mean, it's the same thing.
Kirk is like, all right, I can't do it. All right, Spock, why don't you just push her down the stairs at this point?
You know what? You actually bring up a really good point, because dying in a traffic accident seems pretty painful. They probably could have done it in a painless way.
They could have done it in,
more humane.
A more humane way. Again, but they don't know McCoy is there. So again, there's a little bit of like, well, do we have to kill her now? could I sleep with her a few times?
Yeah,
like,
we've got dinner at 8.
It's not a great look, no matter what.
It's not.
Now, was there another way out of this for Kirk and Spock?
No, I mean, you hit it on the nail on the head. The only way out was preventing McCoy from coming back in the first place. And we saw how terrible they were at that. This is their mess to clean up. They do have to let her die.
I mean, could they have chained her up somewhere?
Oh, no, there you go. Okay, all right.
I mean, how about that? Here, let me just spitball a bunch of ideas.
Yeah, this is good. Okay.
All right, let's take her in the basement. Let's chain her up for 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, does she get out then? And then she's like a Nelson Mandela type figure, and she's like, I have seen the worst of humanity. I have been chained in a basement for the last 10 years. Let me just tell you.
Yeah.
Humanity's brightest days are around the corner, though.
Yes, you're right.
So maybe it's even worse than at that point.
But here's the problem, too, though. I think Kirk does lose her as a girlfriend.
War now.
Yeah. But he loses a girlfriend if he does that.
Okay. So. Could they have taken her back to the 23rd century? Could they have said, Guardian, hey, we're here. We're leaving with her.
Yeah.
Bring us back with her.
It's really funny. I mean, by the rules of time travel, you're really not supposed to do that. Although, of course, they break that rule in Star Trek 4.
She would be dead. But she would be dead.
Yeah. Yeah. Except, but like, you know, if the traffic accident doesn't happen, then how does that person that hit her, how does their day change? And then whoever they encountered.
Well, what was that guy going to do? Have like a life full of guilt and then write like a...
who knows?
Or is he going to enlist? And he was the guy that...
It's the sound of thunder, delicate sound of thunder. You know, you squash the flower or the insect or the butterfly, and then who knows what repercussions it has.
Yeah. Could, I mean, you had bones in 23rd century couldn't fix her in sick bay?
Well, you know what? You actually bring up a really good point. What if they could just tell her, like, here, hey, guess what? Your heart was in the right place, but guess what ends up happening? And they wouldn't have to chain her up. She'd be like, oh, okay, all right, fair enough.
So, all right. So Edith Keeler, here's what, like, let me paint a picture for you. We're going to paint two pictures for you here, Edith Keeler. Okay. Picture number one is that in the real version of 1930, you're dead. Yeah. You died. Okay.
Yeah. We
came here and you lived. Oh, whew, thank God. Well, hold that thought. So you live now, but because of you, you live, then Germany takes over the world and drops atomic bombs and everybody dies. Okay, that's you. That's on you.
It's entirely on you.
So let's drop the pacifist peace act. We need to go take care of Germany. Yeah. Jess, shut the hell up for like the Guardian is going to say, oh, guys, this was cheating. This was cheating. You told her not to do it. Yeah. She needed to die.
No, but yeah, it's like let's drop the peace act, and you know what? We'll still go see that Clark Gable movie. What do you say?
I mean, I just feel like there was no spitballing of other ideas.
Yeah, you're right. They really should have put more energy into it. Although, you know, the end does kind of sneak up on them a little bit.
I mean, the time in 1930 is like the pacing does not move super quickly, but things really start happening like in the last 5 minutes of the episode.
They do. Yeah, there's a lot of spinning your wheels a little bit
in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of like, well, is she going to die? Should she die? Am I in love with her? I think I'm in love. You know.
Yes. Yeah. So McCoy is almost back to normal. He's drinking his coffee. That Kirk is going to go and see that Clark Gable movie with her.
Yes.
And they're out on a date. And she says something that, what does she say that triggers Kirk? McCoy always says that too.
Well, what it was is, I believe Kirk doesn't know who Clark Gable is.
Yes.
Who?
Yes.
It's like, that's so funny. That's what Dr. McCoy said. And like, I don't know why she's name dropping Dr. McCoy.
Yeah,
Kirk
and he's
know who
like,
that is.
What?
McCoy.
Leonard McCoy?
Yeah. Leonard H. McCoy?
AKA Bones?
He was, yeah.
Like, yes. Okay. So then.
Oh, but then he does that weird thing where he calls, he's still holding on to Edith, but he just calls out into the sky, Bones!
You know? Yes. And he just, and then he like leaves her in the street.
Yeah, wait here.
Whatever you do,
yeah.
Don't move.
Yeah.
Stay right here.
Maybe don't leave Edith Keeler in the street.
No, that was intentional. He put her there. That he was putting her on a tee.
Yeah, there's no crosswalk, Rob.
And then he runs back in, and then McCoy comes right out. And then oncoming traffic is headed that way.
Yeah.
And then McCoy goes to go stop her. And then Kirk grabs McCoy and holds him back.
Yes.
And then Edith Keeler ultimately gets hit by the car.
Yeah. And basically Gene Roddenberry, you know, Harlan Ellison really originally wanted Spock to hold Kirk back, but he didn't like that for our hero. So they added McCoy. And so, yeah, that's who Kirk holds back.
Yeah. It's a great line by Spock at the end of the episode when McCoy is beside himself.
Do you know what you just did? He knows, Doctor. He knows.
He knows. He knew.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not a big fan of in dialogue and when someone says a line and then they just repeat it again for emphasis. It's like either it works on its own or it doesn't.
He knows. He knows, Doctor. He knows. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Don't worry. Well,
he's doubling down.
While you crazy pants were running around here for the last week, we've been working very closely on this plan to murder Edith Keeler.
Yeah. But it was a very instinctual or reflexive choice on Kirk's part. I think probably if he had more time to think about it, he probably would have saved her.
Yeah. And if they would have gotten McCoy involved with this plan, I think that maybe his Hippocratic oath, do no harm, I think might have also been, he would have been really conflicted.
Well, this is the good of the one, whether or not it outweighs the good of the many or not. This comes up in Star Trek II. And yeah, there's a perfect example of it where the good of the many outweighs the good of the one.
Yeah. And so eventually we see that Kirk and Spock leap back through the Guardian Forever with their clothes back on. And
yeah, they took the time to change.
Yeah. And so ultimately, the Guardian Forever is like, you know, hey, you want to go somewhere else?
Yes. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Many more voyages. Like, that was fun, right? Messing up history. Like, want to do it again?
Play with me. Yeah. Play with me.
Like, have some rules, Guardian.
Yeah. And so, no, the Kirk says, let's get the hell out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. He H double hockey sticks and Spock, you know, we were successful. He should have said that twice. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And then really kind of a downer end of the episode, kind of rare for the original series.
Yeah, and we had a lot of fun talking about this, but still a timeless story of, you know, of Kirk. I mean, this was really a very, I don't mean to say the word time, but ahead of its time in terms of the, you know, the problems. I mean, there's been so many time travel stories since that period of time, but to really think about, like, would you sacrifice this person in order to have this greater good for humanity? Like,
yeah.
Really, I don't think that there was a lot of that going on television at the point that this episode originally aired.
No, yeah, and it still holds up. The pacing's slow, but I still love the basic plot of it. I think it's a great moral dilemma for a hero to have.
Yeah. This episode in particular, was this one of your dad's favorites?
Yeah. In fact, this is my dad's favorite. My dad loves everything time travel related. You know, mm-hmm. I think he secretly would love to travel through time, but I think he wants to go to
the
future.
Where would he go? He wants to go to the future.
Yeah, he wants things to be better.
When he, you know, the problem is you just don't know what it's going to be like when you get there.
Yeah, well, there might not be a there.
Yeah, that's the tricky part of all of this. So, would you like to see any future version of Star Trek ever return to the Guardian of Forever?
Yeah, I think that would be great. I know that you know, there are a lot of Star Trek novels, and I know in the mm-hmm. novels they've done that. But I believe in the
What's the impetus to visit it in the novels?
I think there was something where something happened in the past, and they're like, oh, let's go use the Guardian. But now with Star Trek IV, we can just loop around the sun at warp 9 or whatever, and you're fine.
Yeah, yeah. That, I feel like that was always really weird, where they was like, oh, we could slingshot around the sun.
Yeah.
And then it was like really like big versions of everybody's faces showed up.
Oh, God, that was really weird. And then you and then you listen, you hear dialogue that hasn't even happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but also if it were that easy to time travel, wouldn't the Klingons have just destroyed the Federation? Like they'd go back to Edith Keeler and do what that, you know, they did.
Oh, so then the Klingons would go back to 1930 depression.
Yeah.
And, but the problem is they just wouldn't know what levers to pull.
Yeah.
Where they couldn't have like gone back to 1930 depression and just like stopped traffic and made sure Edith Keeler got across the street.
I just feel like, I mean,
I guess that they could have like brought some sort of like Klingon, you know, virus to early man.
Yeah.
And then just wiped out most of humanity.
Well, I'm thinking there must be like there must have been a captain's log, and then, you know, there must be WikiLeaks in the future, so the Klingons could get their hands on whatever Kirk said, like, yeah, this one woman,
yeah,
let her die.
Yeah, I thought that it was interesting that even though the Enterprise and the Federation disappeared from existence, Kirk still kept up with the captain's logs.
Yeah. Really dutiful. He believes in his responsibilities.
He kept, you know, going ahead with everything. That was very by the book.
Yeah, very by the book. Yeah, okay. For a guy that makes up the rules as he goes.
Yes. David, well, this was so much fun to talk through City on the Edge of Forever. Is there anything else about this or Star Trek or anything that you want to talk about?
Yeah, well, you know, I can tell you, this is kind of a fun little anecdote. So, I love Star Trek so much. And when I was working at Family Guy, I got word that Patrick Stewart was going to come in and record a voice. And the casting director found out that I was a big fan. And she's like, well, I'll bring him in, you know, after he records. And so I'm in the writer's room, and it's now well past his recording. So I'm like, I guess it's not happening. But all of a sudden, the door opens. In walks Patrick Stewart with a casting director, and she's like, will the real Star Trek fan please stand up? And I was just kind of embarrassed, and I just kind of sheepishly half stood up. I'm like, oh, that's me. And then he just goes, no, you stand up proud. You don't take any crap from anyone.
Oh.
And he hung out and he spoke with us all for like 5 minutes, and like so gracious and fun. And then at the very end, right before he marched out, he just turned to me and he told me to make it so. It was perfect.
Yes, if he could really come by and tell my wife off,
yeah, that would be
ideal.
Yeah, have him over.
If Sir Patrick Stewart could come through. Yeah. With that. Well, this was, I really enjoyed going through all this.
Me too.
And I'm very much looking forward to getting into many more Star Trek episodes along the way. If there's ever another Star Trek episode you want to talk about, The Next Generation.
Oh my God.
Anything along the way. I'd love to do this again. And we are going to end up creating a dedicated podcast feed, which eventually you'll be able to get at postshowrecaps.com/StarTrek. We'll have that up in the iTunes store, and then I'll probably end up doing about 5 or 6 more of these as we go along, as we head into Star Trek Discovery.
I'll be listening. I can't wait.
David, if people want to follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, I feel like I always say this because I'm embarrassed by it. I hate my hashtag, or I hate my handle.
You're,
but it's
at real David Wright,
yeah,
or real Dave Wright.
At real Dave Wright.
At
it's
real
the
Dave
real
Wright.
Part that I really hate, but there's just too many David Wrights. So rather than do a number, I did real. But anyway, there are many real David Wrights out there.
I feel like it's so confusing that obviously there's you, David Wright, and then there's of course the one-time Major League Baseball player David Wright.
Is he coming back?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think he's trying to come back. I think he's attempting many a comeback.
Okay.
And then also there's a political reporter, David Wright, that's really emerged in the last year.
Yeah, is it ABC News, I think
it
is?
Yeah. So it's like David Wright is reporting, like, oh, who?
I think there was a LP album designer for like Yes who was named David Wright.
Yes.
Yeah.
Have you thought about going with Davey Wright? I feel like that might be.
Yeah.
You could break out from the rest of the David Wrights.
I feel like I should be singing I'm a Believer, the Monkees theme or something if we do that. But no. No, Dave Wright, I guess. Or David Wright. I go by everything.
Yeah. I'm a Edith Keeler.
Oh, I'm Edith Keeler.
Yeah, that could be the song parody.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect.
Never saw that car.
You know, it just occurred to me. Do you think the last name Keeler is like kill her? Do you think that was intentional?
Oh my God.
I hope not. That's like, that's too, you're working too hard, right?
It's very dark. I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope that that's what it was. All right. Well, I hope everybody got to enjoy their bricks of bologna and hanging out in their $2 a night flop.
Yeah.
And enjoyed this. Would love to hear what you guys thought on PostShowRecaps.com. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.